Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, a show where each Friday morning we recap the week in Utah news. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, the University of Utah acknowledges that it failed to recognize student Jifan Dong was in danger before she was killed. A Utah oil field spilled 400 barrels near Grand Staircase last fall, and it is still cleaning up the crude after a series of missteps. And the only known photo of Mormon founder Joseph Smith is apparently unearthed by one of his descendants. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we have Salt Lake Tribune public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Roger. I want to let your readers or listeners know that I actually twisted Roger's arm to get on the show today. So, and he only was too good to comply.
It's a good article and worth talking about. And a little bit later on the show, we're going to hear from reporter Courtney Tanner as well and senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Stay tuned for those conversations. You can join this conversation yourselves by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We're also expecting Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke to join us. Let's start with some environmental reporting by Brian Maffley. And Brian, a relatively recent oil spill in an area with a history of spills. Tell us where this happened, when it happened, and how it was discovered.
Sure. Yeah, this oil field's called Upper Valley. It's just outside of the town of Escalante in the Dixie National Forest and the Grand Staircase National Monument. It straddles the line there. And it's been operating there by a company called Citation Oil and Gas. They're a big player based in Texas. It has this interesting past that Leah Hogston, the photographer for the Tribune, and I have documented in the past reporting. But back in October, they had yet another oil spill. This one turned out to be 400 barrels. And we kind of found out about it through tips. The agencies didn't really alert the public about it, but both Zach Podmore and I, our other reporter down south, mm-hmm. got some people called us about it and said, what's going on that oil field? And we looked into it, and there was nothing, none of the agencies announced anything about it. And it turned out, I checked the Department of Environmental Quality spill database, and there was a report about it. Mm. And so we did some follow-up reporting, but the agencies really didn't tell me a whole lot. So I had to go through a public records request to the Department of Environmental Quality to get the information, and the agency wound up providing me with seriously hundreds of emails and photographs and reports to help tell the story. Meanwhile, the Dixie National Forest, you know, I called them about it. They barely would acknowledge that it happened, much less the severity of it.
So the severity. So how much oil are we talking about when you say severity?
Well, the report is at least 400 barrels. That's like 17,000 gallons of crude. And this is a very ecologically sensitive area. It's a high elevation part of the Dixie National Forest. It's maybe 7,500 feet elevation. The drainage is, it's a very high plateau, and all the drainages drain into the Escalante River and into the National Monument and down to Lake Powell. For this particular spill, what happened was there was a pipeline rupture, one of the main sales pipelines in the oil field apparently ruptured, and it spilled a bunch of oil before it was discovered. And it was October 29th. One of the field workers found it.
So just faulty equipment, basically.
Yeah, corroded pipeline. So this oil field dates back to the early 60s. Part of the problem there is the equipment there, the tanks, pipelines, wellheads. Are all pretty old and in many cases are corroded and now compromised, as we saw in this one 8-inch pipeline. 8-inch pipeline's a big line. To describe what happened, the oil moved down into a steep gully for about a mile and then into a wash called Pet Hollow. Pet Hollow drains directly into the Escalante River a few miles downstream, and so they stopped the spill about a mile and a half
And it didn't get to the river?
No, okay. It didn't get to the river, and there were no big rain events that would have pushed the oil down in the river. So they kind of built up a dikes in the Pet Hollow, stopped the progress of the oil, and then started vacuuming it up with these special suction trucks and put the oil back in the tanks.
Yeah, started doing that. I know that they stopped because of winter coming, I think. Is that part of
the... That was their excuse, but DEQ was not on board with that.
You wrote that, you know, I mean, you did these records requests. You wrote that, you know, more than 8 months later, since when this spill happened, cleanup efforts continue.
Yeah.
After a string of missteps. What kinds of missteps are we talking about?
Well, right out the gate, they were... Citation should have reported this spill within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. They didn't report it for more than 72. So three full days had happened before the Department of Environmental Quality, Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management were notified. I think in the grand scheme of things, that wouldn't be a big deal. But this, the BLM, previously ordered this company to report any spill, no matter how trivial or small, within 24 hours. Normally. The spill has to be in excess of 100 barrels of oil to trigger a 24-hour reporting requirement. This spill obviously exceeded 100 barrels. But still, the reason why this order was in place was back in 2014, there was all these washes on the east side of this oil field, you know, flowing directly into Alvey Wash, were filled with oil. I mean, it was crazy. And, they conducted an investigation and concluded that the vast majority of this oil was from old oil spills, perhaps before Citation Oil and Gas took over the oil field from Tenneco in 1987, still, 30 years earlier, right?
Yeah.
But they're saying that, back in those days, grandpa's time, things were done differently. When there was oil spill, you left it there and covered it up in dirt. And apparently there was no record to the Dixie National Forest or the BLM of these oil spills. Of course, this would have predated the National Monuments designation in 1996.
So they said, okay, because of the history of oil spills there, any oil spills that happen, you need to tell us within 24 hours.
Yeah, so. Not just oil, but production water, yeah. Leaky pipelines. These pipelines, as we've now discovered, the flow lines up there, they leak a lot. And there's these kind of small 10, 20 barrel leaks of what's called production water, which is, water that comes out of the ground with the oil and it's contaminated with hydrocarbons. Well, that they have leaks of production water quite regularly.
Hmm. You're reporting, I'm sorry, I have to pause for a second because you keep talking about the fact that it's called Citation Oil and Gas, and it seems there's something funny about the idea that they may be issued, citations for the kinds of things they do well. Yeah. Who knows how they chose their name? Anyway, your reporting draws on information that you obtained from these records requests, and part of that includes the way that the cleanup happened. They don't just leave it on the ground anymore. They do suck it up. And how that happened is now the subject of an entirely different, ongoing enforcement action. Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Department of Environmental Quality really, I think, went after this company. It was pretty hard on them. And the first thing they did was the Division of Water Quality issued a notice of violation within a few weeks, laying out a number of things that needed to happen in terms of, reporting and cleanup deadlines. Things like that, I want to be fair to this company. There's no evidence that this oil contaminated water sources. They have been cleaning it up. It's not like they're just sitting there. But a number of the things that the Division of Water Quality wanted to see happen haven't happened on the time frame that they would like. And one of the things they wanted was this report documenting whether or not water resources were contaminated. The report came out on time, but it wasn't to the satisfaction of DEQ, and they basically rejected it, saying this you haven't conducted a proper investigation. Go back and do it. Take some additional steps. So so for the, you know, the department to say, well, there's no evidence that groundwater has been contaminated, well, we don't really know yet because a proper investigation hasn't been conducted. That was one big thing. The other thing was missing the deadlines.
Yeah, and then the third thing that I think is interesting for your story is the way in which the contaminated ground, meaning the gravel, the dirt and rocks that had the oil on them, how that was disposed of. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so for about a quarter mile in Pet Hollow, the oil kind of pooled up down there at the lower part of the spill, and it got in and it contaminated the gravel in the bed of that wash. And so the company decided a better way to dispose of the gravel wasn't to take it to the Garfield County landfill like they were expected to, but to spread it out on roads. The Forest Service roads around there are fairly dilapidated and could benefit from having some gravel spread around them. So they decided, hey, let's do that. And the Department of Environmental Quality was like, no, wait a minute, time out. That might be a violation of state law, which says you can't put used oil onto roadbeds. It's like straight there in statute, right? And so the company consulted with the local health department and the Forest Service, and allegedly, according to these emails that we got through a grandma request, they were okay with it.
Meaning the Forest Service.
The Forest Service and the health department.
And they just did it.
And they did it in March, at the end of March. In over 5 days, they scooped up, it looks like 2,000 cubic yards of contaminated gravel, and then trucked it over to a Forest Service road, and then spread it out. And part of the records request we got were photographs of that.
The photos that you got from your records requests are amazing. I mean, some of them show these huge, almost swimming pools of oil in this wash.
Yeah, it's not funny, actually, but yeah.
There's a lot more to your reporting, and I guess what happens next here? You clean up, and then is there anything to be said, Brian? I mean, you mentioned the fact that this is a dilapidated sort of part of the world. Are we expecting future oil spills where, you know, equipment failure leads to another thing like this happening?
Here's what I find really troubling about the whole thing. Back in 2014, when the BLM did their investigation, they produced this report, and it was by the National Monument staff did this report, and you know, and this is where they kind of laid down the law for Citation Oil and Gas, saying, you know, 24-hour reporting requirement, quarterly meetings on site with, you know, BLM and Forest Service people to go over problems that might be arising. But the thing they really wanted to, they said they would do, would be this kind of comprehensive assessment of the state of the infrastructure on this oil and gas field. Looking at the pipelines, tanks, wellheads, all the stuff that could leak, and figure out, you know, if it needed to be maintained or upgraded or replaced. Well, I couldn't find any evidence that such an assessment was ever conducted. And had it been conducted, they very well likely could have discovered the corrosion in this pipeline that failed in October and prevented this spill.
And all the clean, and the associated cleanup that followed afterwards.
Yeah,
you know, I want to turn to some other reporting of yours from the world of oil, but maybe I'll ask. You know, Robert Kirky, I mentioned that I kind of made fun of the name Citation for an oil and gas company. I'm realizing that citation can also mean commendation, you know, like an award. Anyway, oil spills in the desert and how they're dealt with. Brian's reporting on this, uncovering stuff that I don't think otherwise would have come to light.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get any commendations for this, but they, first off, I guess we can have the discussion about our reliance on oil and the consequences of that. I think one of the things that struck me about this is, had it not been for Brian digging on this, the public really wouldn't have ever known about it. You know, they sweep these things under the rug, and it's out of sight, out of mind for most people. And I think we need to, you know, I think what this does is it kind of brings home the consequences, the impacts of this form of energy. So, you know, we don't really have solar spills. I don't think we've had any of those. And so we kind of need to start. We need transparency, and we need to recognize the impacts of this on the land. And I, you know, kudos to Brian for doing the digging to pull this out and bring it to the public so we do understand this better. You know, for too long in this state, the regulators have had sort of a, you know, kid gloves approach to regulating the industries that they're supposed to oversee. And it looks like, and Brian can correct me if I'm wrong, that they're actually holding their feet to the fire a little on this one, maybe more so than we've seen in the past.
I don't know if, Brian, if you want to make any comparisons there, but I do want to get to the story of just in the same sort of, I guess, general ambit. It's in the world of oil, a story that we've been following for quite some time, the Uinta Basin Railway. The latest is that, the thing that we knew recently was that there had been federal approval that had been granted, and there were still some legal challenges from environmental groups pending. One of those challenges has now been decided. It's failed for the environmental challenge. Maybe remind listeners what it is that I'm talking about when I say the Uinta Basin Railway, and also, you know, what these challenges are and where things stand.
Yeah, so that is a project proposed by a group of Eastern Utah counties called the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition. And it is a 85-mile rail line from basically Mitton to Price Canyon to the west, where the Union Pacific tracks are. And the idea is, like, we'll use rail rail tanker cars to move the oil out of the basin rather than these tanker trucks on Highway 40 to Salt Lake City, which is how things have been working for years. And it's so the goal of this is to replace the truck traffic with rail traffic, but at the same time, you know, greatly increase the transportation capacity and enable the Uinta Basin oil producers to, you know, produce a lot more oil, 3 to 4 times more oil than they're producing today, which is about 80 to 90,000 barrels a day. This train could potentially move up to 350,000 barrels a day. And the goal is not to move it to Salt Lake City, but to the Gulf Coast, where there's a lot of refining capacity, and these producers could probably get quite a bit more money for their oil.
Yeah. And they have, and this rail line has regulatory approval from the federal government now.
Yeah.
But it's being, or was being, challenged in court on a couple of fronts. Maybe tell us what happened this week on that that area.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of challenges still to come, I would predict. But yeah, the approving agencies are the Surface Transportation Board, which conducted an environmental impact statement, signed off on the project back in December. And then the Forest Service was asked, petitioned for a right-of-way, because 12 miles of the route crosses the Ashley National Forest. Hmm. That has cleared all its challenges as of last week, and the right-of-way is forthcoming any day now, if it's not already been issued. That said, the environmental groups involved, primarily Center for Biological Diversity, has waged a number of legal and public relations campaigns against the project on the basically their main concern is not just the impacts on the ground from building this railroad. It does go through sensitive wildlife habitat and tunnels through Indian Canyon in various places, miles of tunnels. But I think I think the main objection to this is, here is the Biden administration approving a project that's going to, kind of lock in oil and gas production in the Uinta Basin at much higher levels than currently. So basically doubling down on our reliance on fossil fuels, which of course is the primary driver of climate change.
Right. Yeah. I guess is the thing? I mean, I know you said there are challenges pending, but is this basically a done deal at this point? Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of federal approval, yeah, that it's a quote unquote a done deal, but they still need to get the money to raise the $1.5 billion they think is going to be needed. It could be a lot more, and it has to come from private sector sources. So the Seven County Group has partnered up with private industry to pull this off. So the financing is being handled by a company called Drexel Hamilton Infrastructure Partners, and the construction and operation of the railroad is by Rio Grande Pacific. And then those entities, which would ultimately own this railroad, have subcontracted the design of the tunnels and the actual construction to other companies. So all that's been done. The last part now is to get the money. But, you know, there will be more legal challenges. In fact, it's not just environmental groups. And there's a county in Colorado, Eagle County, where the rail traffic will ultimately pass through on its way, the oil rail traffic, that is, will ultimately pass through on its way to the Gulf Coast. So they have sued the Surface Transportation Board, asking for reconsideration of their environmental impact statement because it didn't analyze for the impacts of, you know, 8 or 9 train loads of oil passing through the Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
So that's, you know, so it's the, and I imagine environmental groups will file their own lawsuits.
I mean, and they say, as you pointed out, that this is increasing significantly the amount of our carbon output, fossil fuels, you know, being the cause of climate change. Maybe, Robert, you kind of already commented on that in the last story that we talked about, but just on this railway itself, you know, the counties are saying this is their window onto the world for that industry.
To sort of echo something Brian touched on, you don't build a rail line like this if you don't expect it to operate for 20-30 years, right?
And so
that goes, I think, to what he was saying about the money. I don't know who's going to be really excited about trying to invest make a long-term investment in oil, which but at the same time, if the federal government is giving its blessing to this rail line, it does sort of mean that for the next 20 to 30 years, they envision this as being a viable option. So it's not the federal government, the investors, the oil companies and so forth that would be using it.
Right.
So it is a little, you know, we've heard over and over over the last year and a half or so that that oil companies are having a really hard time getting investors for new refining capacities or new drilling because they don't see it as a long-term viable solution. So I think this still has a lot of basic sort of common sense challenges ahead of it, and it completely apart from the legal challenges. And it is something that kind of, you know, it should make us all kind of say, wait a minute, okay, what do we want to do with this? Is this the direction that we want to go as a country? And but you know, at the same time, they're going to want to kind of continue down this road to maximize their profits. I mean, being able to move that much oil out of the Uinta Basin would probably be a boon for the Uinta Basin, which has been struggling for decades. And so, I can understand why they want to do it. I think the long-term consequences of it are severe, but probably aren't being considered the way they should, but they will be considered. The long-term viability of it will be considered by the people who are going to be asked to pay for it.
Okay. With that, we are going to have to head to our first break in the show. Just in the interest of time, you can find Brian Maffley's reporting on this over at sltrip.com. Brian, there's, I'm sure, much more to be said, and we'll rely on you to keep us updated. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined in studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up. And just in the interest of time, we are going to have to already turn to our final segment of the show because we have two recorded segments coming up. Our final segment is the underplayed stories of the week. And Brian Maffley, why don't I give you first dibs?
Oh, okay. I'm going to highlight a story by one of our new staff members, Palak Jaiswal, who wrote about this interesting art exhibit at the University of Utah Fine Arts Museum, getting into air quality. It's a really great, fresh look at an old subject about the air pollution we're, you know, dealing with in our valley.
Oh, wow.
I really recommend reading the story and checking out this exhibit.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Awesome pick for Underplayed Story. I had not seen it. Underplayed for me, definitely. Robert Kirky, your pick for Underplayed Story.
also a story by Palak. So I don't know if you've been following the Utah Cookie Wars. I'm obsessed by it.
No.
in May, Crumbl Cookies, everybody's had Crumbl Cookies, sued two smaller cookie companies for trademark infringement, saying they ripped off their brand and recipe. And so they filed these federal lawsuits. Now the CEO of Crumbl has went online and was sort of very pointedly accusing these two companies of ripping them off. Everybody in Utah loves their cookies, and I think this is one where, you know, you got the big kid on the block with Crumbl and these two little upstarts that are fighting back. And so it's great. I think it's going to be like the next Star Wars installment.
But Cookie Wars. Yeah. I like it.
Okay. That's how the cookie crumbles.
Oh, there you go. I'm sure there's a lot of puns that could be made. I will forego my underplayed story of the week. Utah hit a million COVID cases. I think that's worth reading about. You can find that and everything else we've been talking about in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke, thank you very much for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Roger.
Okay. Thanks, Roger. Bye.
Now on the show, we are going to turn to a conversation that I have with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner about the University of Utah again having to acknowledge that it failed to recognize a student was in danger before she was killed. Courtney Tanner, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, really appreciate your making time for this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Yeah. The University of Utah has acknowledged, again, errors in how it responded to concerns that a student on campus reported before she was killed. There's a little bit of deja vu here and not, you know, a pleasant version of that feeling. This is reporting from you on the killing of Jifan Dong, but again, with echoes of an earlier story that you also, you know, reported on. And Courtney, just on the starting point here, the headline, what are the failures that the University of Utah is acknowledging here, and how did they come to light? In that, you're going to have to tell us the story of how this student was killed, if you could remind us of the backstory there as well.
Yeah, Jifan Dong was a 19-year-old international student from China who was attending the University of Utah. It was her first year there. She was killed in what police call a domestic violence-related attack by allegedly her boyfriend, who has been arrested and charged with her death. Jifan Dong was killed in February 11th of this year at a downtown motel. And this week, the University of Utah released kind of all of these documents on her case, logs of when she had tried to communicate with the University of Utah housing officials about what was going on and her concerns. And basically what it shows is that she had gone to housing officials pretty early on in the process. So she first went to housing officials on January 14th. 2 days before that, on January 12th, she had allegedly been assaulted by her boyfriend. She was trying to break up with him and he attacked her according to the police report. And she got a temporary restraining order at that point. And then she went to the housing staff because she was afraid. He lived in the same dorm building that she did. They were both, you know, international students from the U. And she told them, you know, look, I have this protective order. I'm scared of what he's going to do next. Like, I'm worried that he's suicidal. I'm worried, you know, he's making threats against me. It just, you know, was this pretty stirring statement, you know, of her concern. And housing officials took reports of that. And these reports, these records that the U released on Tuesday show, you know, all of these reports made to housing, but not a lot of action. They didn't tell campus police about Jifan Dong's concerns until about 3 weeks later, 3 weeks after she told them that she was being abused.
And there were these, I mean, you know, another part of the sort of failings that the university in the documents that are being released, the statements that are released this week, is saying are some of the kind of almost clerical errors in trying to do this. I mean, as part of its review, they talk about how various people who eventually, and I'm not certain of the timeline here, Courtney, you can help us understand that, but who visit Dong, you know, responding to her filing these reports. They say that those people should have distinguished between a, quote, wellness check versus a welfare check. Can you explain that distinction and how that plays into this?
So yeah, when she first went to housing, she had asked for a check on the boyfriend. Again, she was worried he had threatened suicide, which again is kind of a sign of interpersonal violence. And so she asked for a wellness check on him. But anyone describing domestic violence, you know, that these housing officials are trained to see that and kind of raise the flags, right? You know, say that this is a serious situation. So a wellness check is just like, you know, someone's not feeling great, or I'm concerned. Can you just like check on them? Can you just make sure they're okay? A welfare check kind of is one step above that. Essentially, it's that like, there's a danger here. We need to get in contact with these people. We can't stop until we get in contact with them. And we need to get police involved immediately because there is a risk. There is like an inherent danger to the situation. Hmm. And what the U acknowledges is that housing officials who responded to Dong didn't realize that, didn't recognize, you know, those warning signs, didn't raise the situation, you know, failed so many times to get a hold of both her and to get a hold of the man that she was reporting, you know, just all these miscommunications where they weren't responding, or they were actually calling the wrong number, or, you know, calling the number for a boy who had the same name as the man she was reporting. And it just, you know, kind of escalated into this kind of messy communication system where they weren't getting hold of them, but also they didn't bring in police to try to intervene in the situation either.
Yeah. And again, this echoes something in a very high profile case that we have discussed before, you and I, and that you reported on extensively, the killing of Lauren McCluskey. She was killed on campus in 2018. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. October 2018, this case, you know, comes about 3.5 years later and almost identically mirrors some of the mistakes that were made in Lauren McCluskey's case that the U said that it was going to fix the housing problems in particular. You know, the housing officials weren't communicating with police, weren't understanding the problems, weren't, you know, recognizing what is domestic violence and when do I need to alert someone about the danger here. That's exactly what happened in Lauren McCluskey's case. And
it's what the U said they were going to fix. And obviously that, you know, they didn't succeed at fixing that. A statement from the U's vice president for student affairs reads, "In this case," meaning Dong's case, "key details were overlooked and staff failed to make connections with other parts of campus that could have accelerated the university's ability to gather additional information and respond more urgently. This is unacceptable and will not be tolerated." You know, Courtney, maybe we can go forward in time, because eventually the way that the university does kind of begin to kick into action, or into greater action than they had been taking, is when she is basically reported missing. Is that correct?
That's right. So, you know, all of these friends and the professors had started having concerns because they just hadn't seen Dong in a long time. And so they start raising their own flags. And, you know, eventually housing realizes that she's missing, that she hasn't checked into her room in a long time, in at least 10 days. And so that's when they start getting police involved and file a missing persons report.
And yeah, and then there does appear to be, you know, a fair amount of effort eventually to track Dong down, both by, you know, Salt Lake City police and university officials. I mean, there is some concerted effort at that point. There's also, at the same time, some not very professional communications happening over what was really an emergency situation. You know, you mentioned the wrong phone numbers and calling the wrong person at one point. But there was also this sort of like name mix-up thing. There's a lot to summarize in that, but can you sort of pull that together? I'm sorry, Courtney. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right in that, you know, once police got involved, there was a lot of action. You know, they really tried to track Dong down. You know, they eventually, you know, talked to her. She was at a hotel room, but she wouldn't tell them where she was. And so they actually pinged her phone and went into like 7 different hotels that were in that area and couldn't find her, but were trying to check on her. But you're right, at the same time, there were University of Utah staff. This is Utah Global, which is a program that helps international students. And then the Office of the Dean of Students, who were communicating via text message. And, you know, the university has captured it as unprofessional. And I think that is spot on. I mean, at one point they call her Dang and him Wong, which is, you know, mixing up the syllables in their name. They mock Dong's mother. saying that she didn't understand how serious this situation was. And, you know, it just inappropriate conversations at a time when, you know, this is a really serious situation. A student is in danger and they're, you know, having these text exchanges that are not to the highest level of professionalism.
Courtney, I want to get to sort of the profile you wrote, the obituary, basically, you wrote about Zhifan Dong. But before we get there, maybe can you just sort of walk us through the, you know, what actually happened to her in her final moments? I know that eventually she is recovered. It takes some time. I don't know if the amount of time that it took for police to get to her made a difference. Can you just sort of walk us through that timeline and what happened?
So the man that she had been accusing emailed the University of Utah pretty early in the morning on February 11th and said that they were at a hotel downtown. He had bought some drugs on the internet and that they had agreed to take them together to die. Again, this is his words from a police report. Right. And then he says that she started having a reaction to them. And so he injected her with more and she died. And then police arrive, you know, they ping their phones again, police arrive and Zhifan Dong is pronounced dead there. And the boyfriend is arrested and charged with her death.
Okay. Let's interrupt this story, you know, just for a moment before the profile you wrote. And just to get, there is, I know, help available for people who need it. There is a domestic violence hotline. Do you have access to that information in front of you?
Those who are experiencing intimate partner violence or even know someone who is should call the Utah Domestic Violence Link Line. And that number is 1-800-897-LINK or 5465. And there's also the Utah Rape and Sexual Assault Crisis Line, which is 1-888-421-1100.
Thank you for that, Courtney. And now I just, you know, you have this obituary basically of Zhifan Dong that you wrote this week, a profile. You have remembrances from her mother. Can you just give us a bit of a sense of who this girl was, what she liked to do, you know, where she was from and what her life was all about?
I'm so grateful that her parents were willing to share, you know, kind of a beautiful remembrance about her and their memories. Her parents talk about how Zhifan just loved to read. They reflect on how their house is just, you know, stacked full of books still. You know, she'd read anything. And there are just kind of these towers of novels all over that they just kind of can't bear to move because it's their way of remembering her. They also talked about how she loved to cook. She was really an artist in every sense of the word. She could paint and draw and make jewelry and knit scarves. And all of these instruments that she could play, 5 different instruments, including 2 that are traditional Chinese instruments. I mean, just kind of talented in every facet of that. And, you know, kind of a model student. She went to some of the hardest schools in China and got the top scores at all of them. You know, just kind of this superstar girl, you know, that just kind of could do everything.
Well, you talked about her mom there. In your article, you talked about how they, you know, would get on the phone and talk about novels that she had read and sort of bond over that. What's happening now here? I mean, I know that, you know, the U is again scrambling to try to make changes, to come to terms with the mistakes that it made. And then this young woman's family, they have hired attorneys. And in fact, they have hired the same firm that represented the McCluskey family not that many years ago.
That's right. It kind of remains to be seen where that goes, but they have, you're right, exactly retained the same attorneys that represented Lauren McCluskey's parents. You know, McCluskey's parents, just as a reminder, eventually got a $13.5 million settlement with the U, and the U admitted that it could have prevented their daughter's death.
Wow. Courtney, I guess a final question that I have here for you on your reporting, and I'll direct people to your series of reports on this, 3 this week that are really worth reading. Can people feel confident that they will get the help they need if they are experiencing intimate partner abuse? You know, if they're feeling threatened and they are or they happen to be a University of Utah student? Is that a question that you can answer right now?
I think it's a question that's definitely on a lot of minds. And I think it depends on who you ask. You know, if you ask students and parents right now, they're worried. I mean, there are students who say, you know, if I'm experiencing violence and I go to the U, I don't think they're going to help me. And there are parents that are worried about sending their kids back this fall. And it comes at the same time that the U is pushing for more students to live on campus, where it's expanding the dorms. You know, the U, I asked that question to the U spokesperson this week, and he acknowledged, you know, that's a legitimate question, and that people have concerns. They say that they're making these changes, but they've said that before. And Lauren McCluskey's mom, Joe McCluskey, weighed in this week and, you know, said the same thing. You know, they promised that they'd make changes after her daughter died. And then Chiffon Dong has now died about 3 years later, and it was due to the same problems. So I definitely think it's a question that the U is going to have to step in and figure out.
Courtney Tanner is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Courtney, thank you very much for sharing this with us and for your reporting this week. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Again, that's Courtney Tanner, who I spoke with yesterday as she is traveling today. You can find her reporting at sltrib.com. A reminder that this is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll take a quick break and be right back with some more from this week in Utah's news.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we will turn to my conversation with the Salt Lake Tribune's Peggy Fletcher Stack, who had the story of a unique artifact, a photograph that is the only known photo of its kind. Take a listen. Peggy Fletcher Stack, senior religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much for making time for this. Appreciate it.
Happy to help.
So an image, a photographic image of Joseph Smith, founder of Mormonism, has been found. And just before we get into the story of how it came to be that it was found, there were, up until now, no known photos of Smith. Is that correct?
Yeah, there have been lots of alleged ones, daguerreotypes that people think might be Joseph Smith, but there been no authenticated ones to date.
Okay. Well, maybe, Peggy, just tell us the story of how this particular daguerreotype was discovered by a descendant of Smith. Just when and where and how did that happen?
Okay. A guy named Dan Larson, who is a great, great grandson of Mormon founder Joseph Smith. He's just one great grandson of Joseph Smith III, who was the president of the reorganized Latter-day Saint Church, Church of Jesus Christ, reorganized church, that didn't go west with the Mormons and Brigham Young. It was a group that was stayed in the Midwest with Emma Smith, the wife of Joseph Smith, and her son, Joseph Smith III, launched this sort of separate group. And the man, Dan Larson, who found this image is a descendant of Joseph Smith III. Okay?
Yeah.
So he and his family, he got a box of memorabilia, items, artifacts, etc. when his mother died in 1992. And his mother was the granddaughter of Joseph Smith III. One of the items, a couple items, looked like pocket watches. And when she died, he tried to open one of them, but it was stuck and he didn't want to really pry it open lest he hurt it somehow. So just put it in the box and sort of forgot about it. But then in 2020, his father-in-law died, and so now he and his wife had lots of items to go through, and he decided, yeah, I should go through those things from my mom. And there was that watch, what he thought was a watch. This time he did decide to sort of pry it open, and it turned out not to be a watch, but to be a locket that had in it a photo, it was called a daguerreotype, which is an image on metal. And when he, you know, shined a light on it, he really had this strong feeling. It was his ancestor, Joseph Smith. But of course, he didn't know that. And so he contacted his nephew, who's also a descendant of the founder, a man named Lachlan Mackay, who is his nephew and also historian and runs the Joseph Smith Historic Sites in Nauvoo. And Mackay and another researcher spent the next 18 months looking at this, using facial recognition software, comparing it to a portrait, an oil portrait that had been painted of Joseph Smith in 1842, and also Joseph Smith's death mask from 1844. And they seem to line up.
Wow.
In addition to that, though, a big question which everyone has after the whole Mark Hoffman murder forgery issue. Hoffman used to say, oh, I found this in a book in a rare bookstore or something like that. And he always had trouble saying what the quote provenance is, which means the origin and its history.
Yeah.
But in this case, the locket was in the Joseph Smith III family from the time of him and his mother, Emma Smith, until today. So it never left the Smith family.
Yeah.
And there were even photos that they were able to find of Smith women wearing the locket.
Wow.
And that's just a much more, it doesn't mean it's authentic still. That doesn't guarantee it or prove it. But it just is a lot more persuasive than I found it in a barn or something.
Right. Yeah, the provenance. You know, we should say that the idea that there was a photograph made of Joseph Smith, before he was murdered in Carthage, Illinois, you know, in the jail in 1844, that's something, the idea that there was a photograph, that's something that historians have long thought to be true. They just thought that the image was lost, right?
Yeah, people talked about it. Joseph Smith III mentioned it in correspondence and in newspaper letters. So lots of people thought that there was a daguerreotype, but they just couldn't find it. And daguerreotype technology, if you will, came into being in about 1839. And there was a guy named Foster, who was a daguerreotype expert, lived in Manhattan, but then joined the LDS Church and moved to Nauvoo. People think it is likely he is the photographer, and there's lots of reasons to think that. Kind of another aspect of it that checks out.
Yeah, among the things that sort of back that up is that these historians have dug up an advertisement in a Mormon newspaper of the time that advertises lockets with daguerreotypes inside of them. And that's from May of 1844, the advertisement they found. And if that's the case, it's a month before before the events in Carthage, Illinois take place and the killing of Smith and his brother. People listening can go check out the photo, which appears alongside inside of Peggy's story in the Tribune. And one thing, though, that I've noticed that people have been saying, you know, in response to your query on social media about this is, you know, what do you think of the image? Is they're saying, well, this doesn't look like that image from the famous portrait of Smith done in life. Can you talk about that, Peggy?
Yeah, it definitely does not look exactly like the portrait, the oil portrait. But apparently Emma Smith didn't even like that portrait and didn't think it captured him. That's an artist's rendering. The man who did it, David Rogers, was no Rembrandt, let's just say. And so the features, I mean, it's a competent piece for sure, but whether it actually captured the man people knew or not is sort of debatable. The photograph just seems, of course, more real, because it captured him not in an instant like we have today, but in a few minutes, to 5 minutes. That's still, you're getting closer to reality than a portrait.
Yeah, I mean, sit very, very still and I'm going to capture your image.
right, which is why they're are not a lot of smiles.
Right. You know, I know what the descendants believe about this and what and the research that has gone into it. And you talked about facial recognition technology going into it and looking at the death mask, et cetera. It's hard to say 100% yes or no. I mean, couldn't this be someone other than Joseph, another one of the Smith ancestors?
That could absolutely.
For example? Yeah.
That definitely could be the case. And they did, Mackay did tell me that they looked at a lot of other Smith relatives as potential, you know, people that it could be, and other people. But in every case, they just couldn't find someone who fit all the requirements. In other words, the person had to be around this age at this time, you know, that sort of thing. So they went through a lot of the extended Smith family and just checked them off, couldn't find anybody else that they thought matched more closely.
Process of elimination. It's really, I mean, it's remarkable just as an image itself. I think it's kind of striking. And again, I'll encourage people to go check it out. What is the plan with this artifact? I mean, what does the man who owns it, I guess Daniel Larson, want to see happen with it?
Well, he, interestingly, though he's descended from a Community of Christ kind of royalty, church leaders, he joined the Utah LDS Church about 8 or 9 years ago, and he would like to see this photograph in the LDS Church History Library. Who knows? I mean, after my story came out, the LDS Church issued a statement saying that it had examined it, and it's impressive. They were impressed with the research, but they were urging caution as to whether it's authentic or not. So whether Mr. Larson is able to give it or sell it to the library, who knows? The church, given its history with Mark Hoffman, is very cautious about these things, declaring things authentic, but welcomes the conversation, was very involved in, said it had read the article about it in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal before it came out, and it found it very interesting, but
right.
Wait and see is what they said.
Yeah, caution, by caveat emptor, I guess.
Right.
It's just a fascinating history, all encapsulated in your article. I will direct people to check it out at sltrib.com. Peggy Fletcher Stack, senior religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for telling us about this today.
Happy to do it.
And with that, we are out of time. That is it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Find podcasts at kcpw.org. Join us again next week.